Patriarchy and Matriarchy. It was originally presented on February 1, 1980, at Brigham Young University, and it later appeared in Hugh Nibley's book, Old Testament and Related Studies. Patriarchy and Matriarchy. My story begins with Adam and Eve, the archetypal man and woman in whom each of us is represented. From the most ancient times, their thrilling confrontation has been dramatized in rites and ceremonies throughout the world as part of a great creation drama rehearsed at the New Year to celebrate the establishment of divine authority on earth in the person of the king and his companion. There is a perfect unity between these two mortals. They are one flesh. The word rib expresses the ultimate in proximity, intimacy, and identity. When Jeremiah speaks of keepers of my rib, he means bosom friends, inseparable companions. Such things are to be taken figuratively, as in Moses chapter 3, verse 22, and Genesis chapter 2, verse 22, when we are told not that the woman was made out of the rib or from the rib, but that she was the rib, a powerful metaphor. So likewise, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and they shall cleave together as one flesh. The condition is that of total identity. Woman, because she was taken out of man, is interesting because the word woman is here mysteriously an extension of man, a form peculiar to English. What the element W-O or W-I-F means or where it came from remains a mystery, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. Equally mysterious is the idea of the man and woman as the apple of each other's eye. Philological dictionaries tell us that it is a moot question whether the word apple began with the eye or the fruit. The Greek word means a little girl or little woman you see in the eye of the beloved. The Latin equivalent is pupilla, from pupa or little doll, from which we get our word pupil. What has diverted me to this is the high degree to which this concept developed in Egypt in the earliest times. The eye of Re is his daughter, sister, and wife. He sees himself when he looks into her eye, and the other way around. It is the image in the eye that is the ideal, that which is whole and perfect. For it is not good that man should be alone. He is incomplete by himself. The man is not without the woman in the Lord. The perfect and beautiful union of Adam and Eve excited the envy and jealousy of the evil one, who made it his prime objective to break it up. He began by making both parties self-conscious and uncomfortable. "Ho, ho," said he, "you are naked. You had better run and hide, or at least put something on. How do you think you look to your father?" They had reason to be ashamed, because their nakedness betrayed their disobedience. They had eaten of the forbidden fruit. But Satan wanted to shock them with his pious show of prudish alarm. He had made them ashamed of being seen together, and that was one wedge driven between them. His first step, or wedge, had been to get one of them to make an important decision without consulting the other. He approached Adam in the absence of Eve with a proposition to make him wise, and being turned down, he sought out the woman to find her alone, and thus undermine her resistance more easily. It is important that he was able to find them both alone, a point about which the old Jewish legends have a good deal to say. The tradition is that the two were often apart in the garden, engaged in separate tasks to which each was best fitted. In other words, being one flesh did not deprive either of them of individuality or separate interests and activities. After Eve had eaten the fruit and Satan had won his round, the two were now drastically separated, for they were of different natures. But Eve, who in ancient lore is the one who outwits the serpent and trips him up with his own smartness, defeated this trick by a clever argument. First she asked Adam if he intended to keep all of God's commandments. Of course he did. All of them? Naturally. And what, pray, was the first and foremost of those commandments? Was it not to multiply and replenish the earth, the universal commandment given to all God's creatures? And how could they keep that commandment if they were separated? It had undeniable priority over the commandment not to eat the fruit, so Adam could only admit that she was right and go along. "I see that it must be so," he said, "but it was she who made him see it." This is much more than a smart way of winning her point, however. It is the clear declaration that man and woman were put on the earth to stay together and have a family. That is their first obligation and must supersede everything else. Now a curse was placed on Eve, and it looked as if she would have to pay a high price for taking the initiative in the search for knowledge. To our surprise, the identical curse was placed on Adam also. For Eve, God will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow shalt thou bring forth children. The key is the word for sorrow, meaning to labor, to toil, to sweat, to do something very hard. To multiply does not mean to add or increase, but to repeat over and over again. The word in the Septuagint is plethinomai, as in the multiplying of words in the repetitious prayers of the ancients. Both the conception and the labor of Eve will be multiple. She will have many children. Then the Lord says to Adam, "In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life," that is, the bread that his labor must bring forth from the earth. The identical word is used in both cases. The root meaning is to work hard at cutting or digging. Both the man and the woman must sorrow, and both must labor. The Septuagint word means bodily or mental strain, discomfort or affliction. It means not to be sorry, but to have a hard time. If Eve must labor to bring forth, so too must Adam labor, to quicken the earth, so it shall bring forth. Both of them bring forth life with sweat and tears, and Adam is not the favored party. If his labor is not as severe as hers, it is more protracted, for Eve's life will be spared long after her childbearing. Nevertheless, thy life shall be spared, while Adam's toil must go on to the end of his days. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Even retirement is no escape from that sorrow. The thing to notice is that Adam is not let off lightly as a privileged character. He is as bound to Mother Eve as she is to the law of her husband. And why not? If he was willing to follow her, he was also willing to suffer with her, for this affliction was imposed on Adam expressly, "Because thou hast hearkened unto thy wife and hast eaten of the fruit." And both their names mean the same thing. For one thing, they are both called Adam, and he called their name Adam. We are told in the book of Moses that Adam means many, a claim confirmed by recent studies of the Egyptian name for Adam. The same applies to Eve, whose epithet is the mother of all living. And what a woman! In the Eden story, she holds her own as a lone woman in the midst of an all-male cast of no less than 7 supermen and angels. 7 males to 1 lone woman. Interestingly enough, in the lost and fallen world that reverses the celestial order, the ratio is also reversed when 7 women cling to 1 righteous man. This calls for an explanation. God commanded his creatures to go into the world 2 and 2, and yet we presently find the ancient patriarchs with huge families and many wives. What had happened? To anticipate our story, it so happened that when the first great apostasy took place in the days of Adam and Eve, the women, being wise after the nature of Mother Eve, were less prone to be taken in by the enticements of the Cainite world. For one thing, they couldn't. They were too busy having children to get into all that elaborate nonsensical mischief. 7 women could see the light when only 1 man could. The numerical imbalance in the garden is caused by the presence of all the male heavenly visitors on the scene. Why are all the angels male? Some very early Christian writings suggest an interesting explanation. In the earliest Christian poem, The Pearl, and in recently discovered Mandean manuscripts, the Christian comes to earth from his heavenly home, leaving his royal parents behind for a period of testing upon the earth. Then, having overcome the dragon, he returns to the heavenly place, where he is given a rousing welcome. The first person to greet him on his return is his heavenly mother, who was the last one to embrace him as he left to go down to earth. The first embrace is that which the mother of life gave to the first man as he separated himself from her in order to come down to earth to his testing. So we have a division of labor. The angels are male because they are missionaries, as the church on the earth is essentially a missionary organization. The women are engaged in another but equally important task, preserving the establishment while the men are away. This relationship is pervasive in the tradition of the race, what one geographer called the wise force of the earth and the mad force of the sun. It is beautifully expressed in an ode by Sappho. The evening brings back all the things that the bright sun of morning has scattered. You bring back the sheep and the goat and the little boy back to his mother. Odysseus must wander and have his adventures. It is his nature. But life would be nothing to him if he did not know all the time that he had his faithful Penelope waiting for him at home. She is no stick in the mud, however, as things are just as exciting, dangerous, and demanding at home as on the road. In fact, letters from home to missionary husbands are usually more exciting than their letters from the field. So who was the more important? Eve is the first on the scene, not Adam, who woke up only long enough to turn over to fall asleep again, and then when he really woke up, he saw the woman standing there, ahead of him, waiting for him. What could he assume but that she had set it all up? She must be the mother of all living. In all that follows, she takes the initiative, pursuing the search for ever greater light and knowledge, while Adam cautiously holds back. Who was the wiser for that? The first daring step had to be taken, and if in her enthusiasm she let herself be tricked by the persuasive talk of a kindly brother, it was no fault of hers. Still, it was an act of disobedience, for which someone had to pay, and she accepted the responsibility. And had she been so foolish? It is she who perceives and points out to Adam that they have done the right thing after all. Sorrow, yes, but she is willing to pass through it for the sake of knowledge, knowledge of good and evil, that will provide the test and the victory for working out their salvation as God intends. It is better this way than the old way. She is the progressive one. She had not led him astray, for God had specifically commanded her to stick to Adam no matter what. The woman thou gavest me and commanded that she should stay with me, she gave me the fruit, and I did eat. She takes the initiative, and he hearkens to her. Because thou hast hearkened to thy wife, she led, and he followed. Here Adam comes to her defense, as well as his own. If she twisted his arm, she had no choice either. Don't you see, he says to the Lord, you commanded her to stay with me. What else could she do but take me along with her? Next, it is the woman who sees through Satan's disguise of clever hypocrisy, identifies him, and exposes him for what he is. She discovers the principle of opposites by which the world is governed and views it with high-spirited optimism. It is not wrong that there is opposition in everything. It is a constructive principle making it possible for people to be intelligently happy. It is better to know the score than not to know it. Finally, it is the seed of the woman that repels the serpent and embraces the gospel. She it is who first accepts the gospel of repentance. There is no patriarchy or matriarchy in the garden. The two supervise each other. Adam is given no arbitrary power. Eve is to heed him only insofar as he obeys their father. And who decides that? She must keep check on him as much as he does on her. It is, if you will, a system of checks and balances in which each party is as distinct and independent in its sphere as are the departments of government under the Constitution, and just as dependent on each other. The dispensation of Adam ended as all great dispensations have ended, in a great apostasy. Adam and Eve brought up their children diligently in the gospel, but the adversary was not idle in his continued attempts to drive wedges between them. He had first to overcome the healthy revulsion, the enmity between his followers and the seed of the woman, and he began with Cain, who went all the way with him for the sake of getting gain. And Adam and Eve blessed the name of God, and they made all things known unto their sons and their daughters. And Satan came among them, saying, Believe it not. And men began from that time forth to be carnal, sensual, and devilish. Even in the garden mankind were subject to temptation, but they were not evil by nature. They had to work at that. All have fallen, but how far we fall depends on us. From Cain and Lamech, through the watchers and Enoch, to the mandatory cleansing of the flood, the corruption spread and enveloped all the earth. Central to the drama was a never-ending tension and conflict between the matriarchal and patriarchal orders, both of which were perversions. Each has its peculiar brand of corruption. The matriarchal cultures are sedentary. Remember that the mother stays home either as Penelope or as the princess confined in the tower. That is agricultural, Thonian, centering around the Earth Mother. The rites are mostly nocturnal, lunar, voluptuous, and licentious. The classic image is that of the great, rich, corrupt, age-old, and oppressive city Babylon, queen of the world, metropolis, fashion center, the super mall, the scarlet woman, the whore of all the earth, whose merchants and bankers are the oppressors of all people. Though the matriarchy makes for softness and decay, beneath the gentle or beguiling or glittering exterior is the fierce toughness, cunning, and ambition of Miss Piggy, Becky Sharp, or Scarlett O'Hara. The patriarchal order lends itself to equally impressive abuses. It is nomadic. The hero is the wandering Odysseus, or knight-errant, the pirate, the mercenary, the free enterpriser. Not the farmer tied to wife and soil, but the hunter and soldier out for adventure, glory, and loot. Not the city, but the golden horde that sweeps down upon the soft and sedentary cultures of the coast and the river valley. Its gods are sky gods with the raging sun at their head. Its depredations are not by decay, but by fire and sword. As predatory and greedy as the matriarchy, it accumulates its wealth not by unquestioned immemorial custom, but by sacred and self-serving laws. The perennial routine calls for the patriarchal tribes of the mountains and the steppes to overrun the wealthy and corrupt cities of the plain, only to be absorbed and corrupted by them in turn, so that what we end up with in the long run is the worst of both cultures. In this great apostasy, a new relationship of men and women is the keynote. Lamech got the same degree of Master Mahan as Cain did. These dire operations entail great secrecy, and Lamech's wives rebelled against him and declared these things abroad and had not compassion. Wherefore Lamech was despised and cast out and came not among the sons of men, lest he should die. And thus the works of darkness began to prevail among all the sons of men. Thus, with infallible insight, the Book of Moses introduces us into the perennial year drama, which in the past 50 years has become a central theme of comparative world religion and literature. We cannot pursue this fascinating subject here, except to note that from now on, the king in his ambition has to cope with equally ambitious females. Robert Graves takes us through all the primal myths of the Greeks, where this deadly rivalry is the name of the game. In this archaic religious system, he begins, there were as yet neither gods nor priests, but only a universal goddess and her priestesses, woman being the dominant sex and man her frightened victim. Not a healthy relationship, but matriarchy and patriarchy must always be mortal enemies. Why? Because of the last part of the word, the archy. In Bailey's dictionary, the first definition given for the word arche is beginning, specifically the origin of a quarrel or a murder. The second definition is command, power, authority, which is what the quarrel is about. The suffix archy means always to be first in order, whether in time or eminence. The point is that there can only be one first. To be first is Satan's first principle. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Whatever the game, the object is to be number one. Why do we lay more emphasis on the patriarchal order than the matriarchy in our world today? That is unavoidable if we would maintain a balance between the two, for the matriarchal succession enjoys a great natural advantage that, where it prevails, renders the other all but helpless. There is rarely any doubt as to who a baby's mother is, but paternity may always be challenged. In the end, the only assurance we have of a true patriarchal succession is the word not of the father, but of the mother, as the Egyptians well knew. Ma'at is the official approval of the mother, without which no dynasty could be secure. To assure a true patriarchal succession, therefore, requires something in the way of checks and controls on the women, a stricter moral code than that required by the matriarchy, which, as we have noted, tends to become lax and promiscuous with the passing of time. With close rules, safeguards, and vigilant surveillance, it was only too easy for the patriarchs to become arrogant, dictatorial, self-righteous, and oppressive. The gospel sets absolute limitations beyond which patriarchal authority may not be exercised. The least hint of unkindness acts as a circuit breaker. Amen to the priesthood or the authority of that man. Without that sacred restraint, patriarchal supremacy has ever tended to become abusive. A wonderful insight into the archaic order in the bad days after the flood is found in the book of Ether. Now Jared became exceedingly sorrowful because of the loss of the kingdom, for he had set his heart upon the kingdom and upon the glory of the world. Now the daughter of Jared, being exceedingly expert, thought to devise a plan whereby she could redeem the kingdom. Now the daughter of Jared was exceedingly fair, and she did talk with her father, and said unto him, "Whereby hath my father so much sorrow? Hath he not read the record which our fathers brought across the great deep, an account concerning them of old, that they by their secret plans did obtain kingdoms and great glory? And now therefore let my father send for Achish, and behold, I am fair, and I will dance before him. He will desire me to wife. Then shall ye say, I will give her if ye will bring unto me the head of my father, the king." Here the younger king, at the instigation of the princess, a daughter of Jared, seeks the head of the old king, following the ancient practice. And Achish did administer unto them the oaths which were given by them of old, who also sought power, which had been handed down even from Cain. And they were kept up by the power of the devil, to help such as sought power to gain power, and to murder, and to plunder, and to commit whoredoms. And Jared was anointed king, and he gave unto Achish his daughter to wife. Achish is now next in line. And Achish sought the life of Jared, and he obtained the head of his father-in-law, as he sat upon his throne. And Achish began to be jealous of his son, and so starved him to death in prison. Now the people of Achish were desirous for gain, even as Achish was desirous for power. Wherefore the sons of Achish did offer them money. And there began to be a war between the sons of Achish and Achish, unto the destruction of nearly all the people of the kingdom. And it all began with a woman. According to the oldest mythologies, all the troubles of the race are but a perennial feud between the matriarchy and patriarchy, between men and women, seeking power and gain at each other's expense. With infallible instinct, Shakespeare takes us into a timeless world of elemental spirits where a fairy king and queen are found shamelessly bickering over a piece of property, a little slave. Proud Titania and jealous Oberon are playing a silly game of one-upmanship, silly, but with appalling results. All nature is blasted and blighted, and the only progeny of the squabbling pair is universal sterility, described in harrowing detail by the queen. And this progeny of evil comes of us. We are its parent and original. What dismal parenthood! And it all comes of ambition and greed, to which gods and goddesses, as well as kings and queens, are prone. As a sampling of what goes on and on and on, take the Olympian creation myth. At the beginning of all things, Mother Earth emerged from chaos and bore her son Uranus as she slept. The two of them united to beget a race of monsters as earth and sky parted in deadly strife, which, according to Graves, must refer to the clash between the patriarchal and matriarchal principles. The giant children revolted against their father, Uranus, who threw them into Tartarus. In revenge, the mother persuaded their leader, Cronus, to murder his father. Upon coming to the throne, Cronus in turn imprisoned his own sons and married his sister Rhea. Jealous of his children, he destroyed them to keep them from deposing him until their mother conspired with her son, Zeus, to dispatch Cronus exactly as he had his father, Uranus. Prometheus became chief advisor to Zeus, the new king, who chained him to a mountain for being too philanthropic. On the mountain, Prometheus had a conversation with the girl Io, who was fleeing for her life. Zeus had brutally attacked her in his lust, and his jealous wife, Hera, to avenge herself on him, ordered that Io should be pursued forever by a gadfly. Prometheus prophesied to her, however, that Zeus, the supermacho tyrant, would fall in turn before a hero descended from Io herself. And so it goes, on and on. There must be a better way, and there is. It was Abraham and Sarah who restored the state of our primal parents, she as well as he, for in the perfect balance they maintained, he is as dependent on her as she on him. With them were restored the covenants and promises of our first parents. The world did everything to force them apart, and if they had thought in terms of power and gain, it would certainly have succeeded. What was it that kept them together? The patriarchal narratives bring a new and surprising element into world literature. In the most brutal of worlds, they are unique as romantic love stories, in which the female lead enjoys a billing equal, if not superior, to that of the male, with her own name, genealogy, royalty, and fortune, and as much bargaining power as the man. True, all the marriage brokerage is carried on by families and dynasties, with ambitious parents and arrogant monarchs trying to spoil the love match. But God approves of the romance, and for once, the dire attempts at substituting family and dynastic business interests for affection are frustrated. From Abraham and Sarah, down through Isaac and Jacob, and to Joseph and Asenath, that is the plot of the story. Thus Pharaoh, Nimrod, feared Abraham's power and priesthood, as predicted by Nimrod's astrologers, and so first attempted to prevent Abraham's birth by putting to death all the male infants born in the kingdom, and then by imprisoning him as a child, and finally by putting him on an altar from which he was delivered by an angel. Finally, the proud monarch surrendered and conceded that the God of Abraham had all the power after all. It was also a pharaoh who sought the hand of Sarah, the true princess, in order to raise up a royal progeny by her. Upon a royal bed, identical in form with the altar of Abraham, she too prayed for deliverance and was rescued by an angel, while the king was constrained to recognize Sarah's true marriage and heritage, bestowing upon her regal insignia and a royal escort. At God's command, Abraham humbled himself to ask Sarah as a favor to declare herself to be his sister, eligible to marry another and thus save his life. This is only part of the deference that Abraham had to make to his wife, and it left no place for his male pride. Sarah, on the other hand, with equal humility, went to Abraham confessing God's hand in her childlessness and actually begging him to have children by another woman. Can one imagine a greater test of her pride? When both sides of the equation are reduced, the remainder on both sides is only a great love. Again, the apostasy. Recently, scholars have compared Sarah with Helen of Troy, and the latter can show us as well as anyone how the romantic tradition of the patriarchs went sour. It begins with attempts at seduction, wanton perversion of the forbidden fruit. Queenly Hera offers Paris power and gain to get the golden apple from him, while Aphrodite promises him the ultimate, sex and prestige, the world's most beautiful woman for a wife. As for Athena, she is a freak, invented by the patriarchal interests to expedite their takeover of the matriarchal claims. She was not of woman born, but sprang in full masculine armor from the head, not the heart, of the All-Father Zeus, a very masculine damsel, indeed, who always votes with the male contingency. And, of course, she is ever virgin and never a mother.